Here on WEAA 88.9, I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Wednesday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share with the people unless you don't want me to, and I won't. Coming up in the second hour of the show on this Wellness Wednesday, Kenyatta Moon will be here. She is the founder of the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought. She's going to be talking about educating our children, holistic education of our children. And we're going to have a special guest, one of the parents of the Interim Academy, joining us in that conversation as well. Then we're going to talk about a new initiative that is being implemented here in the Baltimore area by Center Stage. It's mobile theater. For those who aren't able to experience the joy of theater, quite frankly, the Center Stage mobile unit is going to do just that. We'll talk about this new initiative that's going to bring theater to underserved communities. That's all coming up in the second hour of the show. A little bit later in this first hour, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Ted Grand and Stephen Janice of the Real News Network, talking about law enforcement and politics, including our thoughts on the death of Freddie Gray 2 years ago to this day. It was April 19th, 2015, when Freddie Gray died after being arrested on the 12th. The uprising happened a few days later after his funeral. So we will get into that, obviously, a little bit later in this first hour. But first, how do we protect our children from the burgeoning horrors of social media? Too many people, I suspect millions of people, witnessed the murder on Facebook Live recently, committed by a man. I believe he was from Cleveland. He just earlier this week killed himself as police chased him. We witnessed a accidental suicide, I believe, on Instagram, and literally myriad of other types of horrific, maybe less dramatic, but still horrific and jarring acts on social media over the past few years. To talk about this, I don't know if I want to call it a trend, but I guess that's what it is. We're joined by our friend Kay Wise Whitehead, Dr. Kay Wise Whitehead, a public intellectual, author, and professor at Loyola University in Maryland. Kay Wise Whitehead, Dr. K, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Sean. It's always a pleasure to be on with you.
Absolutely. Lamont Summers is going to join us in a minute or so. He is assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan State University. As a matter of fact, I think Lamont Summers is walking in right now while the professor gets mic'd up and headphoned up. I'll start off with you, K-Wise. This is an important issue for all of us, but specifically you wanted to talk about it for some specific reasons of your own. I mean, I guess the two biggest reasons are your two sons, obviously. Give me your thoughts. I mean, and the understanding that you have been a victim of social media intimidation because of some of your thoughts, your beliefs, what you write, what you believe, what you think. Talk about how that has been for you and why you think this issue is so important that we have to do what we do.
Well, I'm so glad that you're raising it up on your show. I think I need to just kind of begin by letting people know that I come at this issue from a couple of different angles. In addition, of course, to raising two teenage boys in this new world of social media, I'm also a professor of communication as well as history. So I study these trends. I look at what is happening with communication. I study it with my students, and we talk about it a lot, about how the world has really changed. I know that people often say from one generation to the next that, you know, when we were that age, we had all these things, and they don't realize how good they have it. But when we compare what has happened with the impact of technology and social media over the last 10 to 15 years, we actually can say it is a different world.
Absolutely.
Than it was from when I grew up. The ways in which we've changed in terms of having this spotlight into our lives that we didn't have when we were growing up. I want people to think back, if you are over the age of 35, to when people were bullied. I mean, you were bullied in school 9 to 3. But when you got out of school at 3 o'clock, you went home. And typically, if you called the person, the phones were answered by parents. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have access to the bully after you left school. You didn't have access throughout the night. And the bullying may have started up the very next day, but there was a breathing moment now.
Right.
For kids today, social media bullying continues beyond the school hours. And if they have a cell phone, and even if they don't, there are ways that they're being bullied through social media, and so it never ends. There's this constant pressure that is on people. And with that as kind of one silo, then this other silo is the need to present every aspect of your life. There's something very voyeuristic about inviting people into your lives and into your intimate space. I mean, think about it, Sean. Think about the people who post up, you know, when their grandmother dies and they're in the midst of grieving, but they put a Facebook post up. The people who are in the midst of a romantic dinner and stop and take a picture of the meal to let you know that they're at a romantic dinner. And then, of course, what just happened. I'm thinking first about the young man who accidentally committed suicide while he was on Instagram Live. I mean, he's upstairs, locked the door up in Forest Park, and he had a gun, and somebody on Instagram said, oh, why don't you have the clip in the gun? That's not safe. He begins to put the clip in the gun and shoots and kills himself on Instagram Live while he's showing off this gun. That this is the type of world that we're now living in, where people have access to everything about us if we let them, and even in ways, Sean, if we don't. I'm thinking about the 74-year-old man. He was not on his social media account, but the person who shot him was. He invited the entire world into this experience. And I think we really have to begin to review and understand what is happening and what can we do to begin to safeguard not just our children, right? But this is a 74-year-old grandfather.
Sure.
Protect everybody across the spectrum.
Indeed, indeed. Let me bring Lamont Summers into the conversation. Lamont Summers is assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. He is the co-host of the Media Report with Lamont Summers on Wednesdays. Professor, good to see you.
Good to be here. I'm glad to come in on this timely and very important topic.
Absolutely. So without us getting into the psychological kind of chicken an egg situation, like what, you know, as basically saying, I mean, did social media bring something out of us as human beings, or is it the advent of social media that has propelled this insanity that we've seen? Without us getting into that conversation, when you teach your students, Professor Summers, in your classes, how do you approach the whole issue of ethics when dealing with social media personally, I mean, as far as they're concerned, because Dr. K just laid it out perfectly. It has become so ubiquitous and been so misused that the issue, how do you ethically approach the issue with your students?
Well, when I teach a class, I teach classes in media law and ethics, and I also teach a class in media literacy, and I'm also coming at it being a former practicing communication lawyer. And so, and I'm a strong believer in the First Amendment. And so on the one hand, I teach my students that communicating, using social media tools and technologies to communicate, I think is a wonderful thing. But I think also you have to take responsibility and exercise caution with regard to what you post. For example, when I talk about libel, I say to my students that that many students come at it thinking, and many people come at it when it comes to the First Amendment, is thinking that they can say or post anything without any consequences.
Right.
And of course, I tell them that no, there are there's responsibility, there's consequences. There are certain things that if you post, you could, for example, in the case of libel, you could harm someone's reputation for which you could be sued. And if they win, they could win damages. So I tell students that when you are posting something, make sure you, first of all, that you're doing something that's not going to cause you to have any possible or potential legal liability.
Right.
Secondly, I also tell them to post something and put themselves in the place of the other person. In other words, I want you to empathize, put yourself in the place of the receiver or the people who are going to be watching those posts, viewing them, reading, et cetera, and put yourself in their shoes and ask yourself, how would you feel receiving a post like that? So I try to get them to empathize, to show some degree of empathy towards the other. And so that when they do, so that they question the things that they post and that they try to identify with the receiver of those posts. Another thing I also try to get them to do is I try to get them to ask the questions whether or not a post would they want a post like that posted about their family member, mm-hmm. a relative, a close family member, someone that they dearly love? Would they want to see something like that with respect to a close family member?
There are a couple of points that I want to unpack here with both of you. Number one, you speak of responsibility. I want to ask the question of you, Professor Summers, and you, Dr. K. What is the responsibility in your minds of entities like Facebook? We saw Mark Zuckerberg saying that he's going to figure out a way so this will never, ever happen again on Facebook Live. It seems like a rather tall order, actually. But what is the responsibility of entities, notwithstanding the First Amendment, but what is the responsibility of entities when it comes to protecting people and the public at large from this type of horrific action? Like the worst example, obviously, is this murder on Facebook Live that we recently saw, that people recently saw.
I want to just bring something out because I think that when I heard Zuckerberg said that, I thought that was hilarious because with social media, the people who are using social media are always one step ahead. It didn't happen on Facebook Live. You know, he uploaded it straight to his page. So how are you going to really begin to analyze, study, and watch the millions of people who use Facebook? I think the latest figure said that, you know, if Facebook were a country, it'd be the third largest country in the world.
Right.
That's how many people are on Facebook. How are they really expecting to do that type of micromanaging? I think that we want to just add into this conversation the responsibility that people have, right? So he uploaded this video to his Facebook page,
mm-hmm.
but for it to have been shared hundreds of thousands of times, that's other people choosing to share it.
Absolutely.
Other people choosing to view it. Other people choosing to comment on it. When something goes viral, if we want to use that term, it doesn't go viral because I send it out. It's because of everyone who sends it to a friend who then sends it on. Like there's a whole momentum taking place. So I think a better question is, what is the responsibility of those of us who want to live in a sane and healthy and whole world, and think about the ways in which we are using social media to make these people into celebrities?
But then I come back,
give them their moment in the spot.
Then I come back to that broader question that I started out with, and now we have to go into the pathology of people. I mean, who are these people? I mean, who are these people who would share a murder?
Well, we also have, I mean, newer media technologies, of which social media is one, encourages sharing, and it encourages. I mean, we're looking at a huge profit making business, Facebook, which is encouraging us to post more, use more, because that's how they make their money. They make their money off of us posting as much information about, as much content as possible, and we do it free, and they sell that information to advertisers who are trying to reach us. So Facebook is wearing and other tech companies are wearing two different hats. On the one hand, they're a business and they are promoting the use of their systems. They want us to post more. But on the other hand, they also we have turned over to them, or they have the responsibility of monitoring the content and deciding what gets posted, what doesn't get posted, how much to leave, how long to leave it on, et cetera. I'm on one hand, I said earlier, I'm a strong advocate of the First Amendment. I'm very troubled by Facebook being a censor because, you know, it's a private corporation. And so it may censor things, you know, it's deciding what's to leave it. It's deciding what things to, what content to leave in, what content to take out. Based on who knows what criteria. But when it comes to these violent videos, you know, I think part of the problem, part of the issue is that we've developed this notion, this culture of sharing everything about ourselves, especially among millennials. Now, I know I'm an older, you know, baby boomer. And so for us, because we didn't have these technologies, and also because we came up, you know, being taught that, you know, you're supposed to keep your business to yourself and don't put all your business out there in the street for everybody to see. Well, millennials is different. I mean, they're digital natives. This technology and the use of it is almost like drinking water. I mean, it's like the air they breathe. So for them, posting pictures or things about where they're going, who they're, you know, various things of their lives, this is natural. And so I find it incredible that and I had a meeting yesterday on campus with a colleague of mine, and he actually told me that he watched the video of the what happened in Ohio in Cleveland.
He said he watched it.
He actually said he watched it. In fact, he knew I was from Cleveland. I was raised in Cleveland. And he said, had I seen it? I said, no, I hadn't seen it. I believe it's been taken down. And before I could even say that I would not have watched it anyway, he described to me what was in the video.
Did you ask him why he decided to watch it?
Well, it was in a meeting. It was an executive board meeting with the president and the provost, and I didn't get a chance.
Watch your neighbors.
And we didn't get a chance to talk. I didn't get into that part of the conversation. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking, wow, here's a guy, you know, he's a middle-aged guy, and he was watching the entire video, and he was describing it from beginning to end. And I just thought to myself, I don't know what it is that about a person, and this is a middle class, successful, college educated man, and he was describing the video as if it was just a walk in the park.
But KY's Whitehead, does that not speak to where we are as a society? I don't mean to paint that in such a broad stroke, but I mean.
But I think you're right, though. I think you're right, Sean. When I listen to that, and I'm not appalled, and I am not shocked. I know a number of people who chose to watch it.
Wow.
I did not, because I would like to have some filters in my own life about the type of violence I want to expose myself to. But we're looking at this particular shooting, but I think we can go back and think about Philando Castile bleeding on Facebook Live after being shot by the police officer in his car. We can think about the video of Tamir Rice. We can think of the video of Eric Gardner being choked. I mean, these things were shared over and over and over again. And I actually, in talking to my students, I said, you know, this is becoming like snuff videos, that people are just on a Saturday night kicking back with popcorn, watching the death of black people, commenting on it, and then sending it on to the next person. Like, it's not that we just got here with this murder that happened on Sunday. We've been watching death go across social media and sharing it.
Right.
Since we've really been dealing with the advent of Black Lives Matter, I think that when we think about what happened with Trayvon Martin after the ruling came out with Zimmerman, I marked that kind of as my first moment of using Facebook and Twitter to engage with activism, because I was following so close to what was happening through Twitter, watching on Facebook, watching the ways in which Black Lives Matter began to spread, and then watching the ways in which people were capturing these videos, finding this information, putting it out there, and beginning to share it, and watching it.
Right.
I mean, it was painful. I remember the last time I watched one was when I watched the Tamir Rice video.
Right.
So he's in the park, just no audio, just the video, and I had to stop and say, I don't want to continue to be a part. part of this. I can hear about it and read about it. I don't have to sit here and watch to get this seared in my mind.
Understood. In these last few minutes, I would be remiss. Since we are discussing the culture of social media and media more broadly, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that someone who's identified as one of the biggest media bullies, if you will, no longer has a job at Fox.
Yep.
Lamont Summers gives the thumbs up to that. But the absence or the removal of Bill O'Reilly is a seismic shift, I would argue, in the world of Fox News and sensationalistic news, cable news. Is it not?
Absolutely. But it was I think what was what caused it to happen was the loss of those dollars, those major advertisers leaving Fox News. I mean, 50. The count is up to 50, and it might be even higher. But when they start pulling those ads, I think Rupert Murdoch, who loves money
and he
loves Bill O'Reilly, but he wasn't willing to keep Bill O'Reilly and watch watch just the number of advertisers just continue to leave. And so
I think it came down to money.
Yeah, it came down to economics because, you know, he was able to survive all the other past allegations.
Right.
In fact, the company paid out $13 million
absolutely
to five women.
KYZO, I won't give you the last word on the removal of Bill O'Reilly.
Well, I think it's the same thing that Lamont just said. It comes down to money. We are finding out, and it's becoming painfully clear, that money drives this business. Money is what's driving Facebook forward. Money is what's driving Twitter forward. Money is what's driving Fox forward, that they did not move and they did not make any changes until they begin to lose advertisers. So they begin to lose hard, cold cash. When we think about Ms. U, why did the president end up resigning? Not because it was one guy kind of starving himself out on the quad. It's because a football team stood up and said, refuse to play, going into a weekend when they were going to have, you know, multi-million-dollar national coverage. It's about hitting people and bending your privilege and hitting them where it hurts, which is in the pocket. That's how we get change in this country.
I know you said she had the last word, I'm just reminded of something I used to hear from my students. I'm sure KY, I'm sure you've heard it too. My students used to tell me many times, it's all about the Benjamins.
Well, yes, all about the Benjamins. That's what it is.
There's no doubt about that. Kate Wise Whitehead is assistant professor of communication and African and African American studies in the Department of Communication at Loyola University of Maryland, public intellectual, author, and great person. Kay Wise, thank you as always.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And Lamont Summers is assistant professor of media law and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. He is co-host of the Media Report here on First Edition. Professor, good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me
Of course, of course, of course. We're going to take a break. When we come back, the Mod Squad will be here. We're going to talk about the 2 years to this day that Freddie Gray was died. We'll also talk about the issue of medical marijuana. It's all coming up with the Mod Squad. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Sean Yeo's your host as we make the transition from the perils of social media to the work of the Mod Squad. They are Taya Grant. That is Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. Friends, welcome back.
Thanks for having us, Sean. Really happy to be here.
Good to see you both.
Good to see you.
Where do we begin? Let's start with medical marijuana.
Yes.
Last week we had Cheryl Glenn on. She is the chairperson of the Baltimore City delegation. We had her on the day after the session ended, I believe, and we talked to her about that kind of epic failure, if you will, medical marijuana, the legislation not being passed at the last minute to be more inclusive of people of color being a part of the licensing for distribution of medical marijuana in the state, which will turn out to be, by all accounts, a multi-billion dollar industry.
Absolutely.
But you also recently spoke to Delegate Glenn as well. What were your observations about that?
Right. Well, when we spoke to her, the one thing that sort of stood out to me and surprised me was that when she was waiting for the bill to be heard during literally the last 20 minutes of the legislative session, while she's standing there holding the paperwork in her hands, the legislators took the time to congratulate each other on a job well done and talk about other topics while she's there waiting for her bill to be heard. And it wasn't until the very last 5 minutes that she actually even had an opportunity to present. And I just felt like the discussion I had with her and with the representative for jobs and opportunities task force, Karen York, really seems to me like the Black Democrats are being disrespected. Yeah. Not only were they challenged when they were passing cash bail reform, but now the simple act of saying we would like proper minority representation, Maryland is almost a third Black, we should have that parity when it comes to these licenses being handed out. And they were, honestly, I feel like they were disrespected. Well, and I think she thinks the same.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I still am astounded, having watched many things happen, transpire since the death of Freddie Gray, when, you know, the racial disparity in economics became, you know, a national, international, Baltimore became the international poster child. And, you know, we've had the tax break to Kevin Plank, largest in history, $600 million. And then this, where, you know, we got the statistics today from the Cannabis Commission, and it was like there was just not one single African-American. In fact, it was like 7%. 7% of the people actually own part of the firms were African Americans. So it astounds me that the Democratic Party continues to double down on these policies when we know that they cause tremendous harm to the community. You know, one of the things is that they want to tout, the commission, is that they're people who own small parts, right? African Americans. But as someone who has experience with owning a business, any minority interest in a closely held firm is practically worthless. Yeah. You know, unless you control the majority of it, you don't control anything. You can't make a single decision about that business. You can't even tell people to close the door behind them. So it's absolutely, to me, astounding that the legislature keeps doing these things that aren't going to fix some of the intractable problems that we talk about. Sorry.
Well, no, yeah. You're okay.
You know, I just have to say, too, in relation to the state's priorities, to me, this is astonishing. If my statistics are correct, since 2011, the number of arrests for marijuana possession for African Americans had gone up 58%, and for their white counterparts, it was 4%. Prior to the decriminalization. So it shows that for the state of Maryland, that arresting African Americans for possessing marijuana and distributing marijuana is a priority, but giving them access to legal distribution is not.
Yeah, well, so yes, that's all true. But I think the broader question and much more deeper rooted question or narrative is that, you know, I covered Annapolis, I guess, I don't know how many years, and when I left, I was like, good riddance. and don't ever want to go back.
That's
actually
heartfelt, I can tell.
But part of the reason why is that it was apparent to me almost from the first few weeks of me covering it years and years ago that the when you look at the configuration of the Senate and the House, and you look at the relationship, the dynamic between Black lawmakers and their white counterparts and the leadership of Annapolis, whether it be the Senate or the House, it's ran like a plantation.
Mm.
It looks like a plantation, and it's ran like a plantation. And anybody who tells the truth about what the atmosphere is like in Annapolis, as far as legislatively, and quite frankly, the broader city itself, that's the feel that you get. And we saw Cheryl Glenn, the chairperson of the Legislative Black Caucus, 50 members or 40 some odd members, I don't know the exact number.
Close to 50, it's like in the 40s.
A major kind of voting block, okay?
Absolutely.
Again, as Taya pointed out, represents a third of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Having to beg and grovel with their hands on the boss, can we get one, just one license?
Right. Some crumbs.
Can we get one license?
And it shocks me too, because you would think if you're going to pull a swindle, at least you want to make sure that you can get away with it. So you would have thought that they would have handed out a license to an African American business just for show.
Right. Just make it look good.
Just to make it look good. Yeah. And so to me, and I think to Delegate Glenn, it's such a sign of disrespect. And when I spoke with her yesterday, she to me seemed to be at her very limit, in that if she can't get this special session, if she can't get some minority-owned businesses to get these licenses, she says she doesn't know if she can be a part of the Democratic Party anymore in the state.
She basically said this is why Anthony Brown didn't get elected in 2014, and that, you know, people were not going to vote against Hogan, because what's the point in the African American community? This is what happens.
Well, and then when you think about the treatment of and I'm looking at her face. The representative ran for Senate.
Donna Edwards.
Donna Edwards. Yes.
Well, you saw the thing about Chris Van Hollen, right?
Well, I heard about it.
I mean, I don't know if it's true, but
it probably is. But
the story is that Chris Van Hollen didn't want Hillary Clinton's campaign to work on African American turnout because he was afraid it would lose the election for him in the Senate when he was running against Donna Edwards. This is a story in a book about the Clinton campaign, which to be fair, the Van Hollen campaign denies, but. It definitely relates to what Donna Edwards was saying after the campaign, that she had basically been turned out by the Democratic Party.
Absolutely, and she spoke eloquently and powerfully about about the
during the campaign and after.
Absolutely, and so the question becomes: this Democratic Party that we look at in Maryland, this allegedly progressive party in Maryland. Well, that's a lie from the pit of hell. I mean,
how do you really feel about it?
And to suggest otherwise is foolish. They're not fooling anybody.
Right.
You get to the place where you wind up in the Democratic Party by the boss telling you you can go and get where you are. And if you try to buck, ask Joe Carter.
Yeah, sure.
Yes.
Okay,
if you try to buck, and ask, I mean, she's been the most ridiculed politician I've ever seen.
She was made into a pariah
in Baltimore in my career as a journalist.
Sure. I mean,
ridiculed by her own party.
They didn't even ask her, I guess, at the session to appoint her, you know, predecessor. They didn't even ask her opinion to speak publicly about who she wanted to replace her after she left the legislature to join the civil rights office.
Right.
So. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Right. And, you know, what was interesting when you said how the Democratic Party, the white counterparts really aren't respecting their fellow black politicians. One thing that Karen York pointed out was that the white politicians come forward when they need certain legislation pushed.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it becomes an issue of diversity. All of a sudden, they want the black turnout.
Hey, buddy.
All of a sudden, this is an important social justice issue. And so we need your support.
Well, let's remember that it was the Maryland Democratic Party that thought that Martin O'Malley was a good idea, that he would be a president, not just governor, but president. Uh-huh. And they were the Democratic Party establishment here that embraced him, pretty much bent over backwards for anything he wanted, and thrust him onto the national stage. This is a guy who had executed zero tolerance on the African-American community. So they didn't care. And they still thought he was a good idea. And it ended up embarrassing the state, really, to be honest, because he went out in the national campaign and got 0%. But also,
0.2%.
The city blew up.
Right.
I mean, you're dealing with a party that, you know, I think she's got a point about, you know, Anthony Brown. I think a lot of people in the city stayed home because they didn't see the point. There's no point. I can't blame people for not voting.
Right. And if you're going to lose people, like the possibility of losing someone like Delegate Glenn, who has been a legislative champion for medical marijuana, one of the reasons being that her mother had passed away without being able to get access to
this
cannabis.
It's named after her mother.
Amazing. The Natalie LaPrade Commission is named after her mother and the struggle she had to deal with, pain and loss of appetite. I believe she was suffering from kidney cancer. So this is an issue very near and dear to her heart. And so to hear her say that she might leave the Democratic Party entirely because of this disrespect of the black caucus.
And let me be clear,
I'm
not disparaging the work of Delegate Glenn at all. I'm simply saying that the manacles of the Democratic Party, especially on the black legislators, I mean, what else can you say?
You sat there in the Judiciary Committee, you know, even after our state attorney general, Brian Frost, says that cash bail is is unconstitutional, which strikes me as fairly fundamentally American, saying it's unconstitutional. Bobby Zirkin, a white Democrat in Baltimore County, literally blocked it. Not blocked it, put out a bill after the Black Caucus. After the Black Caucus votes 36 to 4, saying we don't want this. Zirkin gets a bill out of committee, gets it passed through the Senate. Miller sends it over to the Rules Committee in the House, and they still try to push it out. Right. This is after the Black Caucus. I mean, how much more mm-hmm. affirmative or negative vote can you have? That's not a supermajority. That's a total majority. Mm-hmm. And the white power structure in Annapolis says, you know what? We still
exactly.
want. And
we
I don't,
still want
you know,
what we want.
I don't know anybody who thinks, theoretically or logically, that bail is a good thing. Like, cash bail for poor people is a good thing. You know, that you can buy your freedom. There's a price on mm-hmm. freedom. But nevertheless, I watched, and Tay and we both witnessed mm-hmm. it, that they completely disregarded. And also when Catherine Pugh, our own mayor, went down, and again, Zirkin, she said, look, we just want one person on the internal trial boards, one civilian. And they were just like, next. I wouldn't even say that he was respectful of her.
No, absolutely not. And Commissioner Davis really appeared. He spoke after Mayor Pugh did, and he really appeared to be going there hat in hand. Mm-hmm. And they were absolutely not at all open to even the prospect of this. And as I've said before, I saw one of the members of the FOP wearing a purple tie. You know who you are. Gave Zirkin the thumbs up as he was speaking.
Mm-hmm. that image just cracks me up, man.
Pointing at the paper and then looking up and then giving him a big thumbs up. Yeah. Like, thank you for using those talking points.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yost, your host. I'm in the studio with the Mod Squad. That's Tara Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. We're talking politics and law enforcement, including the medical marijuana fiasco. And we're going to shift to the death of Freddie Gray 2 years ago today. But before we shift, let's take some phone calls. People want to get into the conversation for a variety of reasons. Let's go to Brother Leo Burroughs in Bolton Hill. Brother Burroughs, you're on First Edition with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Good evening, my friend.
Good evening.
Good evening, Brother Burroughs.
Great to right hear. On. Give it to him, Mod Squad. Give it to him. Mm-hmm. Look, there are members of the legislative Black Caucus who don't mind being slaves.
Ooh.
And it's not Cheryl Glenn. Cheryl Glenn is courageous. Joan Carter Conway, I think, is courageous. But you've got some of the black men, in my opinion, in the legislative Black Caucus, who don't mind whatever the crumbs that are thrown by Massa from the table, they're gonna slap it up. Ooh. They're gonna lap it up. Senator Nathaniel McFadden, President Pro Tem of the Senate, very silent. Talmadge Branch, Delegate Talmadge Branch, Kurt Anderson, been there 30 years, hasn't he? You know, you're dealing with the three musketeers of institutional racism in Maryland.
Wow.
Bobby Zirkin, Mike Miller, the President of the State Senate, and the Speaker of the House of Delegates is Mike Bush. Well, they're the architects and the continuing three musketeers of ensuring that racism, institutional racism, continues in our state. And again, Senator Dolores Kelly, she just as happy to be there as she can be, not saying a damn thing. Look, they waited until sine die, the last day of the session. They outmaneuvered. It was deliberately set up to outmaneuver us. If you wait to the last day of the session to vote on something, doesn't that give you the indication they never intended to do the right thing?
I think that's somebody true.
in the legislative Black Caucus has sold out the legislative Black Caucus, and it wasn't Cheryl Glenn.
Right. Brother Burroughs, we got to move on.
All right,
thank you, brother. let's go to Clarence next in Baltimore City. Clarence, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you, Sean. Uh-huh. You know, there's an insidious nature to the Democratic Party, be it Republican or Democrat. I was dismayed that Mark Steiner would play into the nonsense that, or try to obfuscate the fact that the Democratic Party is at fault for Donald Trump being in the White House right now. The black progressive millennials, they weren't millennials. They only were labeled and balkanized as millennials. They were voting for conscience. They were voting intuitively that there was something wrong with the system. So the Democratic Party balkanized them by millennials. Now they want to kind of obfuscate and get around the fact that they have failed in this election cycle and over the years by trying to swing the millennials in back into the Democratic Party through the back door as black progressives, excuse me, millennials. There's an insidious nature to that. Excuse me.
Oh, you okay?
I would say to the millennials, continue voting your conscience, and if somebody walks up to you and says, would you talks to you about a black millennial, coconut cake, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Clarence, you got to get some water, bro.
Yeah.
You run away from them. When they start talking ideology, you run away from them and vote your conscience from here on out.
All right.
They are just trying to get you back in Democratic Party through the back door. So run away from them. Thank you.
All right, Clarence, thank you. teachable moment here. Don't eat coconut cake while being on with the Mod Squad.
But you know what? I
you
love coconut cake. I do sympathize. That could have been me. That could have been me right
no
there.
No coconut cake.
That could have been me.
All right, let's go to Big Al next in Baltimore. Big Al, you're on with the Mod Squad.
Hey, man, you know, if we see Donald Trump's tax return, we'll get some marijuana licenses in the state of Maryland, I'm sure. and the same lackeys who are selling us out with the marijuana are pushing that state senate project. And you know, people need, you know, there needs to be an investigative report about that state senate project to see where the money is coming from, where it's going to, who's going to benefit. You know, a complete analysis and then analysis should be done in the Afro and laid out very plain and simple for people to see the real truth.
Give me 30 seconds on why do you think that that's an issue? How the funding for State Center? Why do you think that's an issue?
Because that phony company just came out of nowhere for a $1.3 billion contract, and you got all these black minority contractors in this town, and tell me how come they couldn't be doing that project?
Well, I mean, that's
well, you know, Al is correct. Do you want me to say something?
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, Al, you know, I don't know what the deal is going to be now, but the state awarded that without going through the procurement process. We actually did a number of series on this, and it was a billion.
I wonder why.
Yeah, no, we did. Well, right, it was O'Malley giving it to. It was a white developer who ended up getting the contract, and O'Malley had characterized it as capitalized leases, so it was considered not to be a contract, but in a sense it was 20 or 30 years of guaranteed, this is what people don't understand, guaranteed leases. So it was one developer who was going to have access to about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of guaranteed state leases so they could build this, and it was a very unusual deal.
I understand that.
That's a little bit different, though. I don't know what the deal is going to be
right now.
This is before.
Thanks, Big Al.
Before Hogan was elected, right. It might be different
now.
But
the whole point is that, and notwithstanding the shenanigans of Martin O'Malley in that whole deal, it still has taken. It's been stuck for 10 years.
That's true.
And again, notwithstanding how the process went.
Mm-hmm.
The promise of the project, at least
yes.
The promise of the project.
That's true.
Promises many, many, many jobs for
absolutely.
Many people.
But this is,
and a revitalization of an area that needs it.
This shows how pernicious, you know, not following the rules can be.
Well,
because
true.
He didn't put it through procurement. He wanted to give it to a developer through a backdoor kind of deal. And it became a legal issue because of that. And thus we're all suffering. But I think everybody agrees that State Center needs to be revitalized.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's take one more call. Let's go to Thomas in Churchville. Thomas, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Sean, Mod Squad, how you guys doing?
Hey, Thomas, how are you?
Listen, let's not be fooled by these people, okay? Cheryl Glenn, Dolores Kelly, John Carter Conway, they had no intentions in getting this bill passed. They want to come out at the last minute, Sean, to make you think they were doing something for the African-American when these are the Negroes that's been selling us out the whole time. Case in point, witness the same Congressional Black Caucus who turned their backs on then candidate Donna Edwards and C. Anthony Mills.
The Congressional Black Caucus may have turned their backs on Donna Edwards, but Anthony Mills, that's the legislative, that's the state. But I get you. I mean, I hear your point.
And, you know, let's think about it, guys. If you want to know who these developers are that's getting these contracts, I heard Mike Miller said a while back that he was going to leave office and end up being a consultant for some of these people. Mm-hmm. I think we should find out when this special prosecutor is going to indict Mike Miller.
Yeah, that could take a while.
Thank you, Thomas. Appreciate it. Yeah, the most powerful man in the state, bar nobody. I think I think that's fair.
Absolutely accurate.
I think that's a very fair assessment. Absolutely.
Every dollar comes to I think.
I would just have to say though, like just from the conversation I had with Delegate Glenn the other day during an interview, I do think that she was genuinely, truly concerned about the medical marijuana issue. The Maryland Cannabis Commission is actually named after her mother, who passed away from kidney cancer and couldn't get access to marijuana, which really could have helped alleviate her symptoms and been excellent palliative care. So, you know, I can't speak for the rest of them, but right. I would have to say she did seem genuinely concerned.
But I think that's the whole point. I mean, I think that to try to somehow disparage Delegate Glenn and suggest that she wasn't authentic in her desire to get this done, that's a difficult task. That's a slippery slope. Mm-hmm. But there's so much skullduggery that takes place in Annapolis that's why everybody gets caught up. Mm-hmm. And that's why everybody gets kind of lumped together in this incompetency that we find and even worse. We only have...
Well, when you structure entire political structure about excluding a large group of people, you know, it does kind of corrupt the whole system and everybody who's participating in it.
True.
You know?
Let's take these last few minutes and talk a bit about 2 years ago today. Freddie Gray died after being arrested in the Gilmore Homes on April 12, 2015. A few days later, during his funeral or after his funeral, the uprising was sparked. Changing the landscape of the city, the trajectory, quite frankly, I think, of the city in a lot of ways forever, or at least for many decades to come.
I think, you know, Tay and I used to talk about it, you know, prior because we were covering, I was covering policing and she was studying, and we just kind of wondered what it was going to take to sort of tip the scales in the city where the city people would finally say enough. And I think it has been a transformative moment because it certainly transformed the perception of how people think about Baltimore. You know, it used to be we were thought about as the Wire, and now we're seen as a city that really, you know, sort of erupted and let people know what was really going on. I think it's kind of been, you know, it's been difficult because to me, as we were just talking about, it doesn't seem like the changes have occurred that I thought would occur. But at least people, you know, at least this city is a more complex town, and a town with people who actually care more than just being fodder for David Simon and a television show.
I mean, I think one thing that we can say is that the conversation has changed before, listening to the mayor speak. You wouldn't hear the mayor say that we want to even consider taking money from policing and putting it towards education. That was just not a part of the conversation previously. So, you may say, you know, we're not seeing changes occur as quickly as we would like them to happen, but the conversation is different. After the Department of Justice came in and wrote their scathing report, we do have a consent decree in process. The hearing could have been stalled because of the Department of Justice being led by Jeff Sessions, but instead, James K. Brader, the judge, moved forward, allowed the public to be heard. So there really is a chance for some change. There are people who could understandably be cynical and say that it's superficial, that it is all talk, but I think we are at least moving in the right direction now.
Yeah.
I when we think about the death of Freddie Gray and we think about what happened to him in the back of that van, one of the main narratives that came out of that scenario was the issue of protocol and policing procedure, even with arresting people. And you wonder sometimes, because we had that story about the other day, the woman who was arrested in Calvert County and they let her go home to get her hair done or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully that's an anomaly. But then you think about the seven cops indicted for racketeering. And we have the fact that Ivan Potts was arrested by three of those cops, and we know what happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
So we hope that's an anomaly. But I just wonder what lessons we've learned as far as law enforcement is concerned. I mean, there have been some changes, obviously.
Mm.
But how many people left police headquarters with their boxes after the uprising? And the only person I saw leaving with a box was Anthony Batts, the commissioner.
That's a good point.
Well, I do think, that, you know, as Taya pointed out, that we are having for the first time a conversation where people seem to be acknowledging that policing isn't going to be the solution to whatever problem.
It's not the panacea.
Yeah, it's not the panacea. And that is the first time that's ever occurred, but it's been slow coming. And it's not moving at a fast, swift pace that I think it needs to. Because, you know, I was talking to someone, some cop today was telling me, he's like, the consent decree is the worst thing that ever happened to policing. And I said, policing in Baltimore is the worst thing that ever happened to policing. It wasn't the consent decree or the Department of Justice or the protesters. The police department did this themselves. I mean, this was their behavior and their actions. And I think, Sam, what you're talking about is will the people who run that police department ever really feel connected or accountable to the community? And that, I don't know if that's happened yet, because I don't
some
know.
Some do. But
I'm not
but,
saying that a lot of them do. But, well, I don't know a lot of them. But
some, I'm saying some do. Yeah. But and typically the same ones come to my mind every
yeah,
time
right,
I think
exactly.
about it.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like a Melvin Russell or something.
Yeah, 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 yeah. You know, but then you think of just think about, again, the question we've asked it 10,000 times during this segment, where are they coming from?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where are they coming from? And what is their connection to Baltimore City? What is their connection to the culture of Baltimore City? What is their connection to the people of Baltimore City? Do they understand the people of Baltimore City? Do they understand the history of Baltimore City?
Well, and we're going to work on the Ivan Potts story, who was a young man who was arrested by the Baltimore Seven, and we've been sort of trying to tallying up the costs. And, you know, one other thing I think that from Freddie Gray that we need to consider is the cost, the price of this decision we made to embrace policing. You know, these seven cops were paid almost $750,000 a year, mm-hmm. year over year. We paid for that. And we're just starting to tally up the cost of this one arrest. And it's going to be in the hundreds of thousands, not including the toll. Because I talked to Ivan today, and he is, you know, he is lost right now. He is having trouble because
he has
just,
to rebuild his life.
He has to rebuild
scratch.
His life. I mean, I think the conversation has to be much faster, much swifter, more decisive about this is not helping. I mean, of course, when you hear about a 90-year-old woman getting shot in her lawn, on her front lawn because she told someone, you know, but still, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And we're going to make that the last word for this segment of the Mod Squad. Ted Graham and Stephen Janis are with the Real News Network. They are the Mod Squad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Friends, thank you. Good to see you
thank
as always.
You, Sean.
See you Friday.
I brought a record for you. It's in the car. I'll bring it on Friday.
I'll be here, bro.
Okay. You like vinyl, right? Do you play
yes.
vinyl? Okay, cool.
Yes, sir.
All right. I've been putting together.
Thank you both. Appreciate
mm-hmm.
it. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, the second hour of First Edition on this Wellness Wednesday, Kenyatta Moon, the founder of the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought, will be here. That's next. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.